You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 161 by Rudolf Steiner. 13 lectures entitled Artistic Sensitivity as a Spiritual Approach to Knowing Life and the World, translated by Rory Bradley. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on February 6, 1915. Yesterday I presented the story of Manon de Gossin because it contains an accurate description of the after effects of the etheric organism, the etheric body, following death. It goes without saying that not every novelistic or artistic depiction of such things can be presented as I have done, because the artist might have created instead a highly inaccurate depiction, and one might end up presenting something false. But I selected an example that depicts the after effects of the etheric body in a truly accurate way. It relates to the actual facts in an objective way. This is one of the first things that you encounter in spiritual scientific knowledge, that when a human being steps through the gate of death, the etheric body, astral body, and I, capital, dissolve their connections with the physical body, and a kind of transitory state begins in which the physical body is on one side, and the etheric body, astral body, and I, still connected with one another, are on the other side. Of course, we know that after a relatively short period of time, the etheric body separates from this grouping, and the human individuality remains connected with the I as it undertakes its journey through the cosmos with the astral body during the time between death and a new birth. Now we must be clear, and recently I have stressed this often, that the etheric organism, the etheric body, is predetermined to carry us through earthly human life to maximum old age. A person who reaches old age has, of course, the same etheric body that he had as a child. So if a human being, during one of his or her incarnations, must leave the physical plane early, one example that comes readily to mind is our dear Theophis, thereby causing the etheric body to separate from the astral body and the I, then this etheric body finds itself in a different circumstance than if the individual had reached an older age, which would have allowed the forces within the etheric body to be spent over the course of decades. The forces and energies that are still present in the etheric body when a person dies young could have been applied to a longer life if the individual's karma had allowed the person to remain on the earth. This application amounts to nothing more than an ongoing use of the etheric body. An etheric body that separates from an individual who dies at a young age has a lot of unused energy within it. These forces are still contained in the etheric body. These forces and energies, which have now passed over into the spiritual world, are ones that could have sustained a physical life for a long time. It goes without saying that these energies are not destroyed or negated when a person passes through the gate of death. For nothing is destroyed, and this is far more true of the spiritual world than it is of the physical world. All energy and force simply transitions to another form. We know, of course, that this law of the conservation of energy has played a big role in the physical sciences since 1842, when it was introduced by Julius Robert Mayer. It is applicable everywhere, even when it comes to the most basic things. For example, if you run your hand across a surface, you use energy and force. This energy is not lost. The spot becomes warm. The force and energy of pressure and friction is transformed into warmth. No energy, no force is ever lost. It simply transforms. Energy in the spiritual world is also never lost. We can say that, in the spiritual world, the energies of the etheric body that come from those who die young, which will no longer be used to sustain a physical life, are instead applied to everything connected with the human individuality that lives on in the eye and the astral body. These energies that would otherwise have been used for the individual's existence on earth are instead used in the spiritual realm. They remain in the elemental world, just as the etheric body itself dissolves into the elemental world. Within the elemental world, these energies form a true reservoir of energy, an energy source. This is indeed a very significant phenomenon, for it illuminates for us the connection between the physical world and the spiritual world in a concrete fashion. It does not amount to true knowledge to imagine abstractly that the physical world is connected with the spiritual world, or that the spiritual world lies somewhere behind the physical world. The spiritual realm that lies behind the physical world is a wholly different provenance. There are many different things in the spiritual world that immediately surrounds us that can be traced back to those unused energies of the etheric body. The art of clairvoyance, which is particularly significant for physical human evolution on the earth, owes much to these unused etheric energies. The things that these etheric energies infuse into the elemental world that lies directly behind our physical world are particularly stimulating to both clairvoyant and spiritual scientific knowledge. Make sure you grasp this fully. We can be grateful to those like Theo Feiss who have passed on before their time, because their etheric bodies have given much to our elemental world, and many, many spiritual influences have streamed directly from those etheric energies to us. I think that I need hardly say that such influences can extend only from those souls who die according to a truly natural progress of their karma, and never from someone who has died because of an act of human will, such as suicide. In those cases, things are very different, because the fertile energies of the etheric body are destroyed by the resolutions that come out of the consciousness Maya that I spoke of yesterday. It is this form of consciousness that produces all resolutions about death when one is still alive on earth. This is just a side note, as I mentioned. All this is to say that the etheric bodies we have just been discussing lie at the base of the spiritual impulses that we experience. The spiritual movement that we serve must therefore show extreme gratitude for the things that are given to it by these energies, as we can surely recognize. Perhaps I also do not need to point out how significantly this enriches our knowledge of the kind of love and tribute that we owe to those who have passed on, based on our ability to distinguish between the gratitude owed to those who have died at a young age and those who have died at a ripe old age, who have taken up the otherwise unused energies of the etheric body into their own individualities. Those who die at an older age, and we have also experienced this in recent weeks, take what would otherwise have existed only in the etheric body and incorporate it into the astral body. Those individuals have taken something that would otherwise have been cosmic and made it human. This process, then, causes the significant spiritual impulses of which I have spoken to emanate from the individuals themselves. And so these individuals have a great effect on the world, because these impulses can then be taken up in the hearts of individuals who do not have access to spiritual, scientific, or clairvoyant knowledge. Individuals who engage only with normal impulses in their everyday lives can be influenced by spiritual impulses, thereby enabling them to have as part of their souls something that flows into the spiritual world in a more human and less cosmic way, in which our souls are already always embedded. Thus we have denoted several different things that can be sought in what I would like to call the spectrum of death. The etheric organism that remains behind after the I and the astral body have detached from it. I would like to call this the spectrum of death. This spectrum contains the kinds of forces that I have just described. But there are also many other things present there. In order to study the other things that are a part of it, we must go back to something that I sought to place before your souls by presenting that passage from the novella. Here is a fact that I told you about, and that you can see in the events of the novella, that a karmic connection existed between Manon de Gassin and the man who eventually shot himself. A connection that is, of course, the result of prior earth lives spent in contact with one another. Such a karmic connection exists in all works of literature. These ongoing connections, particularly the strongest and most significant among them, can be traced back to the fact that the karmic connections that existed during the prior earth lives were not lived out to their completion. Manon de Gossin finds herself in an encounter with a man who loves her. She does not understand his love, and her consciousness Maya makes her bristle at the idea of fully living out her karma. This leads to the conflicts that can be realized so effectively in art. Because people's consciousness Maya always makes them rebel against things that are karmically predetermined. Of course, these things cannot simply be done away with. I do not mean to say that karma can simply be done away with. Indeed, it must be lived through in the next incarnation. A person cannot escape his or her karma, except in the most infrequent of cases, and in those cases, the karma must still be transformed. But the soul can attempt to not live out its karma fully during an incarnation. When this happens, the kinds of conflicts arise that we see in the novella. A person leaves the physical plane, and that karma has not fully taken the form that it was supposed to take. But the course that karma should, in quotes, take is not inscribed into human nature. One's karma should perhaps reach a certain stage of fulfillment, but to some extent, by failing to recognize our karma in a particular incarnation, or by striving actively against it, we can push off the fulfillment of that karma to a later incarnation. But it is still within us, inside of us. we, quote, wash the karma out, close quote, as it were, out of the experiences of one lifetime lived between birth and death. And this is how the things were washed away that Manon de Gossin and the man who loved her would have experienced had they fulfilled their karma. It is washed away from the physical events of their lives. But the place that it cannot be washed out of, the place from which it cannot be erased, is the spectrum of death. There it remains as will, or even as desire, shall we say. And so it is that after such a person dies, this spectrum of death follows the will of its unfulfilled karma. So if Manon de Gossin seeks rest, then at the appropriate moment, the spectrum of death comes to her for the very reason that the will which should have brought the two of them together continues to live on in that spectrum of death. The things that should have occurred but did not are then enacted by the spectrum of death, insofar as such a spectrum is able to carry them out. So in this regard, the circumstances that are described in this novella are very accurate. We can say that aside from the things we have already discussed, the unfulfilled karma is also contained in this spectrum of death. And after a person dies, something occurs in the elemental world that is like the unfulfilled karma being played out through a sequence of images. Now, take careful note of this. We are really dealing with something twofold here. When a person dies with unfulfilled karma, it is necessary for that karma to be fulfilled in a later incarnation. That will happen at some point in the future. But in the spectrum of death, something like a prophetic, imagistic depiction occurs of what will one day have to play out, what should have already played out but did not. So when you consider the spectrum of death with clairvoyant vision, what you experience is unfulfilled destiny and karma. We can say that in the human spectrum of death, a process occurs that could have occurred during life but did not. Thus, an image of processes that could have been life processes can be experienced in this spectrum of death. This is a very significant esoteric condition. The factors that comprise human individuality, the I and the astral body, move almost immediately after death into a kind of cosmic existence and remain connected for several days with the spectrum of death, with the etheric body, in such a way that the unfulfilled karmic will of human individuality is active out in the cosmos as part of the spectrum of the death. Then, after several days, what belongs to the cosmic sphere separates from the particular and unique being that an individual had through the connection with the physical form, a form that the soul had taken on only because it was enclosed within a physical human body. The I and the astral body do not have this physical human form, but the spectrum of death and the etheric body also have approximately this physical human form. And over the course of several days, the spectrum of death loses this human form, because once the soul has separated from the physical body, it loses this human form. The physical body had, through its own power, contained this spectrum of death within its form. Once the spectrum of death is outside of that form, it takes on other forms that are determined by the external powers of the cosmos. In a sense, it is therefore quite understandable that an accurate description of the exit of human individuality from the physical body, which takes place together with the etheric body, must be described as though the spectrum of death rises up in more or less the form that once belonged to the physical body. So if someone wants to describe the moment of death accurately, he or she will describe how the etheric body rises up, as though it were a cloud. And, in rising up, it maintains the form of the physical body, with its arms and other limbs, only then to dissolve slowly into the more spiritual forces of the cosmos that begin to work their way in. This is a transformation, a metamorphosis, a transition. Clairvoyant imagination is difficult for us because the human being is bound up with time and space during physical life, that is, with those forms of time and space that we have available to us in our physical bodies. With three-dimensional space and one-dimensional time with its past, present, and future. And many people have a tendency, when engaging with purely spiritual perception, to cling to these ideas of three-dimensional space and one-dimensional time with its past, present, and future. We can indeed speak about space and time in relation to the spiritual world, but they are truly different there. This is the difficult thing. The words we use for the physical can only be poorly applied to descriptions of the spiritual world. When you speak about time in the physical world, what is past is truly past. The past lies behind us, and we can grasp it only in memory. In direct visual perception, we can have only what exists in the present before us. The spiritual world is not the same. Things are already different when it comes to the elemental world. There, the past can also be present immediately before us, just as the present exists before us in the physical world. So, you can look upon what is past, upon what has already happened, upon the things that for the intellect can only be grasped in memory, the things that you can no longer look upon in external life. Once you have stepped through the gate of death, you can look upon an earlier moment in time from a later one. It is just as though from a later point in space-time, you can look upon something that is physically past, as though it existed in the present. Just as I can look from this physical point where I am standing over at the corner there. The past is really there. It stands as a living thing before us. It surrounds us. Such a perspective becomes particularly living when the sort of thing happens that happened to us recently, when we had to cremate our dear friend, a situation in which her first experience of consciousness occurred in the moment when her physical body was consumed by flames. In this moment, her consciousness became active. But before the physical body was surrendered to the flames, we had the memorial service. And this memorial service can be observed by the deceased right now, just as though it were something happening in front of her in the present moment. Such things belong to what we might call the most esoteric aspects of our esotericism. But over the course of many years, we have striven to have as many opportunities as possible to speak with one another about such mysterious processes in the way that one might otherwise speak about the typical events of the day. And what we can say is this: our esoteric lives, will have a much, much more energetic and intimate character after the difficult period of war that we are currently undergoing than they ever had before. For many people, because of this general suffering, it will become possible to go much deeper into all sorts of areas that we currently must keep silent about, because we are currently living in a period of great transition for humanity. This is precisely because of the suffering that humanity has undergone. And I do not mean individual suffering, because that always leads to egotism, but rather the general and universal suffering that collective humanity has experienced. Let us take a more intimate look at this process, whereby human individuality, which is to say the I and the astral body, together with the etheric, step out and depart as a threefold human being from the physical body. This is a process that lasts for days, but begins when the human being moves through the gate of death. This process shows in a particularly living way how cosmic forces can be present in the human etheric body. But it also shows, as we have now seen, the unfulfilled karma. This is a process that is truly different for each individual person, a process that is not the same for any two people. This is also why it is so difficult to describe these things, because they are not the same in any two cases, but rather always slightly different. When we look closely at this process, it becomes very clear that there are many different things within the spectrum of death. I simply cannot describe them all at once. But if we are at least aware of two particular things that are contained in the spectrum of death, we already have a more intimate understanding of it than we would if we just connected a phrase, the idea of the etheric body, in quotes, to the spectrum of death. Unfulfilled karma is within the spectrum of death, and this brings about the possibility of generating artistic conflicts. The possibility of bringing unfulfilled karma into connection with these processes that occur after death. A purely exoteric artist will have to be satisfied with simply establishing the conflict and then letting his characters die. But when the artist contends with esoteric conditions, parenthesis, for example, in Shakespeare's works, as I have mentioned at various times in the past when I have talked about the things that lie behind Shakespeare's works, close parenthesis. When the artist shows the connection between events and deeper laws of life, when the artist describes circumstances with a consideration of the things that lie behind the external processes, then the result is the sort of thing that we have in Hamlet, for example. There we have a truthful depiction of unfulfilled and untransformed karma playing out in what we see in Hamlet's father. In that sense, the dramatic conflict for the major players of the drama, for Hamlet himself, begins largely through the influence of his father's unfulfilled karma. An artist who is in the position to grasp the connection between the physical world and the spiritual world will often feel compelled not to allow a character to fall away at the moment of his or her death, although that is how the monists and the materialists imagine it, but will instead give some indication that this passage through the gate of death is actually an entry into new experiences, into new processes that are more concrete than the concrete life processes that play out between birth and death. In order to show how art can strive to be enriched by turning the moment of departure from earthly life into the continuation that extends into spiritual life, I spoke to you about the novella from which I read an excerpt yesterday. But it is generally interesting to observe how a person can arrive at a perception of unfulfilled karma, how a person can describe something that can be felt in the fullest sense of the word as unfulfilled karma. And if the artist has described unfulfilled karma, then he may also feel compelled at the end of his artistic depiction to consciously point out the fact that it was unfulfilled karma. And this can lead the artist to feel compelled to depict the ways in which this unfulfilled karma can be expressed through a sort of genuine elemental imagination that can come about when we take up life in its totality and not merely in its physical aspects. In connection with this, I would like to speak about another piece of art whose content I can outline only briefly, much more briefly than yesterday, because in this case I am dealing with a 2-volume novel. You will see that in the depictions it contains, something about unfulfilled karma also emerges. I will try to indicate as quickly as possible the extent to which unfulfilled karma is expressed in this work of art. A mother comes with her daughter from America to Europe. The father died some time ago in America. On their trip, they encountered the descendant of an old noble family, deeply rooted in tradition. A wide variety of processes then play out. For those who can observe things and their connections with the spiritual world, it immediately becomes clear that karmic connections are woven between the man who is named Arthur in this work of art and the 2 women whom the man simply sees on the street as they are going into the theater. These karmic connections then lead to the complicated relationships that play out. They play out in such a way that the whole opposition between European culture, which has grown old, and American culture, which is still young, is depicted in a great cultural tableau. The absolute opposition of these 2 cultures is depicted with penetrating insight and devoted love. Its representatives are Emmy, the daughter, and Arthur, who encounters her and begins to love her fiercely. The opposition is then reflected in these 2 souls. And many things occur that, for those who have their eye on spiritual scientific connections, appear immediately as results of the karma that is at work between the 2 of them. In a sense, the external milieu that one contends with when dealing with the coming together of an American and a European worldview is something that is connected with the fresh American culture, untouched by historical traditions, and the antiquated European culture that lives entirely on the basis of traditions. In the whole context of this milieu, something lives that is reflected in these 2 souls, bringing about conflict after conflict. This ultimately leads to the last great conflict, which comes about because of Arthur's father, who has passed away, and who owned a tract of land and manor. He still stood entirely in alignment with the traditional worldview of the old nobility. But he had also grown apart from the old noble traditions with his money, or rather with the spending of his money, which has happened so often in Europe. And the land and manor have fallen into debt. The estate has been sold, and Arthur has inherited the value of that estate. Now, in the most elegant fashion, which is not always the case, it happens that because of the way in which the American relationships are established with the European ones, a small improvement comes about. Emmy is able to help with her money, which is to say that her mother can buy back the estate for Arthur. This happens, or at least it is supposed to happen. On the estate, there is an unknown offspring who has remained there. He cannot say where he came from, but he conducts himself like a vagabond there on the estate. Of course, it does not belong to him, but in his imaginations, which we might call mad, he gets the idea that he is the lord of the estate, and this brings him to the idea that the estate should belong to him. From his perspective, if the estate is to be repurchased, this is a violation of his rights. But his rights come only out of a sort of decadent madness. He considers himself the lord of an estate that has long since been surrendered to the bank. He carries on like people who are mentally disturbed tend to do, in a way that is not exactly dangerous. And so a conflict plays out that causes this man to grow furious about the sale of the estate, and as soon as the opportunity presents itself, he goes out and shoots Arthur on the estate. Emmy has already gone through several terrible experiences, and now she has to go through this one. As a result, she develops a kind of sickness that carries on in her disposition. At this point, she is going into her 20s. Her mother brings her to Montreux ill, and there in Montreux she is attended to by a Mr. Wilson, an American who is depicted in the most sympathetic fashion, as well as by a few others who are there. The way in which Mr. Wilson is described is truly a wonderful moment, an absolutely remarkable passage of this piece. In a way, all of North America is alive in him. This is brought to life in a wonderful fashion. But Emmy cannot be healed, despite the fact that she is attended to in such a way by this doctor who has come into her life, by this man who is in some sense Arthur's rival, but who is also his old friend. She dies in Montreux, and her death is described. So let us consider from a spiritual scientific perspective that here, in the utmost sense of the word, we are dealing with unfulfilled karma, with karma whose threads have been broken everywhere, a karma that has led to conflicts, conflicts that play out primarily between America and Europe, a karma that was concluded with a gunshot. Those of us who can perceive this, if we are not materialistically inclined, we'll have to ask ourselves, quote, where is reality? Where does this unfulfilled karma go immediately after death? Where does it live on? Close quote. I would like to suggest that anyone who is not a materialist has some sense of the way in which this karma lives on. And so, those who are artistic must then feel a need to give some indication of the way in which it lives on. And we find just such an indication at the end of this work. Now, I need to read you a few lines. Arthur is dead. He has been shot. Mother and father have traveled to Montreux. Emmy has been ill for a long time, and Arthur appeared to her in her last dream. But it is immediately evident to us that this is not merely a dream image, a dream of reminiscence. Rather, we are dealing here with the influence of the real Arthur in the physical world. And now, the moment of Emmy's death is described as follows. Quote, between midnight and morning, she thought that she awoke. Her first glance toward the window, through which the dull illumination streamed, was free and clear, and she knew where she was. She even heard her mother, who was lying next to her, breathing. But not one moment had passed, and then she felt a pressure like she had never felt before, and she was overcome with fear. It was not just those individual thoughts which had tormented her in the last few days, but rather the sense that a giant hand was holding all of the mountain ranges of the earth above her by a thin thread. And at any moment those fingers that held the thread might open, and the whole mass of them would crash down on her, to remain there on top of her for all eternity. She let her gaze roam about both inside and out, seeking a shimmer of light, but no light offered itself. The glow of the window had vanished. Her mother's breathing was no longer audible, and suffocating solitude surrounded her as though she might never again reach the world of the living. She wanted to cry out, but she could not. She wanted to move, but none of her limbs obeyed her. She was completely still, completely dark. She could not even grasp onto thoughts any more in that state of terribly monotonous fear. Even her memory had been taken from her, until, finally, one thought returned. Arthur. And now, wonderfully, it seemed as though this one thought transformed into a point of light visible to the eye, and to the extent to which the thought grew into a boundless yearning, the light grew as well, approaching and expanding, suddenly springing about and reforming, taking the shape of Arthur, standing about her. She saw him, and she finally recognized him. It was, without a doubt, he himself. He smiled and was close to her. She did not see whether he was naked or clothed. It was simply he. She knew him too well, he himself, and not merely a phantom that had taken his form. He stretched out his hand toward her and said, "Come." His voice had never sounded so sweet and enticing as it did that day. With all of the strength she had, she tried to raise her arms toward him, but she was unable to do it. He came closer to her and reached out his hand toward her even more. "Come," he said again. Emmy felt as though the strength she was using in her attempt to make one word cross her lips would have been enough to move mountains, but she was unable to utter even that one word. Arthur looked at her and she at him. If she were only able to move one finger now, she could have touched him. And now the most terrible thing. He seemed to be moving away. "Come," he said for the third time. And she, feeling that he had spoken for the last time, that terrible darkness might break again over the heavenly sight of him, filled with a fear that tore her apart the way that frost cracks tree trunks, she made one final attempt to raise her arms toward him. But she was unable to overcome the weight and the cold that held her fast. Just in that moment, before her very eyes, other glowing arms grew up out of her arms, like a bud bursting into flower. Other glowing shoulders grew out of her shoulders. These arms extended toward Arthur's arms, and he took her hands in his, slowly retreating and pulling her along with him, and with her the whole luminescent form that emerged from Emmy's body. Close quote. Steiner again. This is a wonderful description of the moment of death, the exit of the etheric body, the transition of the spectrum of death into the cosmic realm. In this spectrum of death, which is described as being spiritually visible as it exits the body, the self-determined life will is contained. The unfulfilled karma that exists between Arthur and Emmy is contained in the expression of this spectrum of death. I am presenting this example to you because in the novella that I mentioned yesterday, you could see how the spectrum of death came only to the one person who was still living, establishing a relationship with that living being. Here, on the other hand, we are dealing with two purely spiritual entities, with the etheric body that comes from Arthur, which has already undergone a number of transformations in the spiritual world, and the spectrum of death from Emmy, which is just beginning its exit from the body. So in this case, we have an old, unfulfilled relationship, unfulfilled karma, between Arthur's etheric body and Emmy's spectrum of death, which is just beginning its transition into the spiritual world. in the spiritual world, something is playing out that was unable to play out during life, something that had been left as unfulfilled karma. We must try to really and truly understand these first moments that are experienced after a human individual passes through the gate of death. Indeed, the things that remain there as unfulfilled karma separate from human individuality in those moments. The human individuality can fulfill that karma only in later incarnations. So it separates and becomes a part of the cosmic world outside of human individuality. It turns into cosmic events and experiences, and some of the things that happen in the clouds, on the mountains, and in the springs, in the things that happen in the unconscious soul processes of the human beings who live here on earth. The unfulfilled karma, that primal source within the spectrum of death that is taken into the spiritual world, is at work, expending its energy and fulfilling itself in all of those places. For cosmic events are constantly at work in human life. We are entirely filled by them and interwoven with them. And so, we must differentiate between what becomes cosmic, as it were, and what remains individual when a human being moves through the gate of death. What remains of the physical body becomes cosmic in the fullest sense. This either happens slowly in the case of a burial, or more quickly in the case of cremation. The physical remains transition into the elements, which is to say the world of Earth's physical elements. And it is a very materialistic imagination to believe that these remains simply disappear, or play a role similar to the one played by chemical elements. This is nonsense, and tomorrow we will see how the forces that have great significance for the planets continue to live on in them. These remains live on in planetary life. The chemists know nothing about what becomes of the physical body. The most significant condition on Earth is the fact that the human being has lived on it and died on it. These are the most important forces that remain. The earth is also made up of the physical aspects of people who have died. In this way, the physical body becomes something cosmic. The other aspects of what becomes cosmic come from the etheric body. And today I have tried to indicate how the cosmic aura becomes cosmic. The rest of what remains from the etheric body lives on as individuality in the higher spheres. You will find more detailed descriptions of this in my book titled Theosophy, and also in title An Outline of Esoteric Science. Part of the etheric body lives on as individuality, and I will have more to say about that tomorrow. However, we must be clear about the fact that what lives on individually begins to live in a set of new conditions that are fundamentally different from the typical ones we experience on Earth. If you study the Vienna lecture cycle about the life between death and a new birth, you will come to understand some of this. It is possible to describe only some aspects of it at one time. Above all, you can make a clear assessment about the conditions between death and a new birth only if you grow accustomed to living with the imagination that linear time, as we experience it, past, present, and future, is nothing more than a physical maya that we penetrate in the moment of death. In the moment of death, we break through into another world where the past exists not merely in memory, but rather stands before us and surrounds us as though it were the present. A world where the human being lives under conditions that reveal its inner being in the form of its external being. People live there in such a way that their inner soul being is revealed and made visible. The same thing that was given form by the physical body and physical existence here in the physical incarnation between birth and death. The way in which we must begin to learn to conduct ourselves in relation to those who have stepped through the gate of death relates not so much to an attempt to see them as visions, but rather to have an inner experience of community with their experiences. The individualities of those who have stepped through the gate of death are still there, fully and completely, even though, as I mentioned yesterday and as I will continue to discuss tomorrow, human beings who have moved through the gate of death first have to orient themselves in the flood of consciousness that is experienced. But their essential being is there, even if they are not always connected with their consciousness. They are there, and they can be seen. It is possible to share in the experiences, so to speak, of the essential being of those who have passed through the gate of death. You see, I have made an effort in relation to the sad experiences that we have gone through on earth with the loss of dear friends. I have made an effort whenever I have had occasion to speak from out of the souls, out of the essential being of the people in question. Tomorrow I will be speaking about something different, but I would like first to say a few things about the three friends of ours who have died recently, inasmuch as I am able to do so here. My only effort here is to speak out of their souls, to speak with the voice of their souls, so to speak. And now, if I look back on it, I find that there were good reasons, very good reasons, to speak in an individual and different way in each of the three instances. The three people are, after all, different from one another, and I really do mean to speak in a different way, in the fullest sense. I readily admit that this was not part of my consciousness as I spoke the words. The words developed entirely out of the situation at hand, and words that are to be used for spiritual science, and also for things that are a part of life but connected with spiritual science. Such words develop best and most truly when they are not influenced in even the most subtle way by life wishes and desires. If you want to speak properly and truly in the realm of spiritual science, you must hold yourself totally separate from every wish to express one thing or another. You must hold at a distance every desire to have things be one way or another. When you find yourself called to speak at the memorial service for a dear friend, there is, of course, no desire on your part to have to be in the situation where you need to speak those words. This seems totally understandable. The words are not said out of any sort of desire, but out of necessity. It is understandable that in every single instance of this sort of thing, the only wish you might be feeling is the wish to not have to be speaking such words. This is something, I would like to suggest, that positively influences the generation of words. This is why it was particularly important for me, and I say this with great humility, that in the first instance for our dear friend Frau Großheinz, I spoke merely as the expressive organ for her soul itself. A soul that has lived a long life on earth, one that in its last years of earthly life connected itself with all of its powers of soul to the impulses of spiritual science so meaningfully and energetically, connected itself in a more selfless way than most of us are able to do. When such a soul moves through the gate of death, these living spiritual scientific impulses are really living there in the soul, not just theoretically, but in a very practical way. They are simply alive there in the soul. They are there even if the soul has not yet awakened to the point that it has begun to perceive them. They are there, and this is the characteristic aspect of the part that separates away. And so you will admit that something lay in the words I spoke today that we might call transformed spiritual science. Spiritual science transformed into will and feelings that must emerge from the soul because it has lived through a long life on earth and moves through the gate of death full of rich etheric forces. And in these instances, one is obligated to speak from out of this soul. This is why it was not possible to say anything except what the soul itself might have said. And so those words came, quote, "Into the cosmos I will bear my feeling heart, which grows warm in the fires of holy forces. Into the world thoughts I will weave my own thought, that it might grow clear in the life of life's eternal becoming. Into the depths of soul I will plunge devoted meditation, that it may grow strong for the true goals of human striving. Toward God's peace I will strive through the struggles of life and its cares, preparing myself for its higher self. Toward work-loving peace aspiring, within me the intuition of cosmic being, I would fulfill the human duty. So shall I, awaiting, live toward my star of destiny, which grants me a place in the realm of spirit." Close quote. Steiner again. The inner living movements of the soul are represented by the fact that first, at the beginning of the ceremony, the words had to be spoken, quote, "toward my star of destiny," close quote, and then at the end of the ceremony again, quote, "toward my star of destiny," close quote. It is the proximity you must have to the one who has passed through the gate of death that causes words like this to be produced, which are particularly fitting to the being corresponding to the person in question. I would like to connect what I have to say about the other two friends with other thoughts that I will share with you tomorrow. The end of Lecture 6.